I don't know whether you've been inspired to do any spring cleaning at this time of year. It can often be a time when that thing that's been dirty for several months, that little part of your house that's been untidy all winter, or that thing that's been broken for a long time, all of a sudden you just feel inspired to go and to clean it, or to tidy it, or to fix it. Normally it only takes about 20 minutes, and you're wondering why on earth you let it sit for so long. But it can be a time when we just want to do a little bit of spring cleaning and tidy things up a little bit. Now, I know some of you would never let your house or your room get to that stage to begin with, and it's always going to be very clean and very tidy. If you are one of those people, you're always very welcome to come visit me in my kitchen in Belfast, where I'm studying at the moment. I share a kitchen with 12 people, many of whom are undergraduate students, and haven't quite learned that after you use something and put it in the sink, there's a couple of steps after that. And we thankfully have two sinks in our kitchen. One is just a constant pile of dirty dishes. And we all give out about it. We all complain about it. We all blame, you know, it's always somebody else's mug that's in there. But when it comes to it, it doesn't really bother us that much to actually do anything about it. You know, it's untidy, we know it's untidy. It's messy, we know it's unmessy. We don't like it, we'd prefer it not to be, but we don't actually do anything about it, and so the pile just stays there. Our only saving grace is one of the other students who lives upstairs, loves cleaning, and when she's procrastinating assignments, will come down with her rubber gloves and cleaning supplies and clean our kitchen for us, and then it's tidy and perfect. But she just can't stand the mess and needs to clean it up. This morning we're looking at a story where Jesus comes in and he cleans the temple. He comes into the temple, the place of God, and sees that it's not right. It's not clean, it's not tidy, it's not working properly. And he just can't stand that. And he has to go in and he has to do what he can to clean it. And this morning maybe Jesus is looking into our lives and into our hearts. And maybe he sees things in there that shouldn't be there. And maybe he wants to clean them up this morning. And so we're going to consider that as we look at this story together. We're going to look at it through the eyes of three different people in the story. We're going to look at the pigeon seller, we're going to look at the temple authorities, and then we're going to look at the disciples. And we're going to see that Jesus has a passion for purity, that he has all authority, and that he is the true temple of God. So first let's look at the pigeon seller. This scene is taking place in the temple courts, which you can see here. So the temple was the very center of Jewish worship. There were three parts. There was the kind of holiest of holies, and then there was the holy place, and then there was this big outer court area. And this is where this scene is taking place. Three times a year, all Jews were to go to the temple for special festivals and to make sacrifices to God. And this time is one of those days. So people from all over the world would have been traveling to Jerusalem, traveling to the temple for this festival. So it would have been very busy, very packed. But on top of this, you've got all these farm animals there as well. Now, the Jews were required to make sacrifices. And if you're a baker in Greece and you have to make a boat journey to Jerusalem, it makes sense in some ways to be able to buy your sacrifice there. So you can just go and you can buy your sheep or your cow at the temple before you go and make your sacrifice. So that's why you had these buyers and sellers there. They were providing a service for the worshippers. Also, people were required to pay a temple tax and it had to be in the local currency. So people would have to come and they'd have to change their money and pay their temple tax. So the busy temple is even busier at the moment. So no matter all the people that are being there, you've also got, you know, cows and animals making noises. You got people changing money. A very busy kind of market feel to it. And so in the midst of this, we have our pigeon seller. Maybe he looked a little bit like this. I'm not sure. But he would have been there and he would have been offering to sell pigeons to people that were coming so that they could make sacrifices. Don't know what his motives were. Maybe he was corrupt. Maybe he was trying to charge huge prices to prey on people for their sacrifices. Maybe he was more genuine and believed he was really providing a service for these worshippers that were coming. Maybe he was more genuine in his motives. Maybe he was just a businessman looking for ways to make money. We're not quite sure, but he's there trying to sell his pigeons and his doves. And then as he looks across the temple court, he sees a man he's never seen before. And he's got a whip from somewhere. And he's just driving out all these animals from the temple. And you just kind of imagine what that scene would have been like, the chaos that it would have caused as he's driving all these animals out. And he goes over to the money changers and he flips over their tables and the money's scattered everywhere. And then he comes over to the pigeon seller and he says these words, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" And I imagine as Jesus says these words to this man, he does it with authority, with passion, with sorrow perhaps, but a very kind of commanding and definite way. Now he doesn't sell to the pigeon, he doesn't tell the pigeon seller, he doesn't say, "Get out of here." He's no problem with the pigeon seller himself, but it's what he's doing, it's his practice. And I think the issue is that he's just in the wrong place. You know, if he wants to go outside the temple and sell his pigeons, that's fine. But the temple is a place for prayer and for worship. And in the outer courts, that would have been the only place that non-Jews could have gone to worship. And how could you worship God effectively if there's somebody selling pigeons in a market beside you? This is just not the right place for this kind of thing. And that perhaps these pigeons were kind of preventing the true worship. Because the temple was heaven on earth. It was the meeting place between God and man. It was God's special dwelling place among his people. The place that God's presence was meant to flow out. That the temple was meant to have a purifying effect on the city of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem would have a purifying effect on the nation of Israel. And that Israel would have a purifying effect on the whole of the world. But if the temple itself is not pure, if it has become corrupted and polluted, then how can it be the place it was meant to be? And so Jesus is passionate about purity, and these pigeons are upsetting it. I was speaking on this passage a few weeks ago, and it so happened that the day before there had been a cake sale in the church. And there were a few buns and tray bakes left over. And people would have had the opportunity to, you know, take some buns and leave a bit of money to the side of it. And so this stall was set up as I was saying goodbye to people afterwards. And a few people made a comment, some just kind of joking and some a little bit more seriously. But, you know, should we be throwing this table of buns and tray bakes off? Is this what this passage teaches us, that we can't do things like that? That we should just kind of stamp on these lovely buns that people made and throw the money around. But I think that shows a common misconception, that we think of our church buildings as a replacement for the temple of God. But the New Testament says that that's actually not the building that is God's special place, but it's his special people. That God no longer dwells among his people in a building, but God dwells within his people through his Spirit. So the question is not so much what goes on in our buildings, but it's what goes on in our hearts. It's not what are we doing in our buildings, but what is going on in our hearts. So my question is, maybe there are some pigeons in your life this morning. Bug on to the next one. But maybe there are things that you're bringing to church in your life that shouldn't be there. Maybe you're disrupting the purity within you by bringing pigeons, things that are distracting you from your worship of God, things that are interfering, things that you are doing in your life that you know are not right. Let me just give you an example of what some of these might be that Jesus says in Mark chapter 7. In Mark 27:21-22, Jesus named some of these impure things that can come into our lives. and maybe some of them are in your heart this morning. Evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, folly. These are the things that can often pollute our hearts and can come in and can pollute our church community, can distract us from our worship, distract the church from being what it should be. All that passion that Jesus has for a clean temple, all that zeal he has, all that desire for purity is now focused on our hearts and on our lives. And maybe there are things that Jesus sees in us and he says, get these out of here. The next people we encounter in the story are the temple authorities. In the text, they're referred to as the Jews, but we get the sense that these are the rulers of the temple. The temple was not just an important part of Jewish worship, but it was absolutely central. If you wanted to pray, you would go to the temple. If you wanted to worship God, you'd go to the temple. If you wanted to make a sacrifice or an offering or find forgiveness, you'd go to the temple. If you wanted to experience God's special presence or witness his glory, then you would go to the temple. And for these temple authorities, this was their building. A big moment for me, I started working at a church up north in Carrickfergus, and a big moment for me came the day I got a master key to the building, because I feel the minute you have a master key to a building, you feel very important. You feel that you've got a bit of power and control over the place, a sense of ownership, because you can kind of open doors and walk in. So it was a big moment for me, and I was very excited about the first time I'd be there and kind of open the door for myself. But of course, I didn't actually have a little clicker that goes with it. And so I still left outside, kind of knocking on the window, till a small child came in and let me in. But I love having master keys to places. And in fact, I like to hold on to them as well, even after I leave places. And so I do have a little box of keys of various places. But I'm sure the church committee here never has that problem and never has difficulty getting keys back from people. But there is that sense of when we have keys to a place, we have a sense of authority over it, a sense of power over that place. And we like to hold on to it, and we never like to give it up if we don't have to. Now, I'm not sure if the temple had keys, but if it did have, then the temple authorities would have been the people that had all the keys. They had access, they could go in, and they weren't likely to give it up. And Jesus comes in and he challenges their authority. They had let this practice of buying and selling in the temple courts go on. Maybe they even encouraged it to happen. And then Jesus comes in, this stranger they've never met before, and he immediately challenges their authority. And so they asked him, what miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? They wanted to see some amazing miracle that would show Jesus had the right to do this. But the truth is, they didn't actually want to see a miraculous sign. Because as the story of John goes on, even when they do see miraculous signs, they still refuse to accept his authority. And in fact, this is the first of many stories where there's conflict between these Jewish leaders and Jesus, where they are refusing to accept that he has authority. And so as it comes to the end in John chapter 10, 47 and 48, they say, after they've seen him bring a dead man to life, they say, here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. And then in verse 53, so from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Even when they saw miraculous signs, they still refused to believe that Jesus might have authority over them. They were not willing to give up their keys that they had. And Jesus replies, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. And of course, they misunderstand what Jesus is saying. They think he's talking about the actual physical building. You know, how could you build a building this size in 3 days? But what he was actually talking about was his body. And this is an early prediction of his resurrection. And he is saying that his resurrection will be the ultimate sign to these temple authorities and to everyone that he has authority. Because if you can come back from the dead, then it shows that you have power even over death itself. That these religious leaders tried to show they had more power by Jesus by putting him to the death, but he showed that he had supreme authority when he came back to life again. His resurrection is his credentials that shows that he has authority to do whatever he wants in the temple, and it is a sign to us that he has authority to say whatever he wants about our lives. So the question this morning is, who has the keys of your life? Are you accepting Christ's authority over you, or are you trying to resist him like the temple authorities in some ways? Maybe you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, and there's maybe parts of the Christian message that you like, but when it comes to the fact of Jesus telling you what you have to believe, telling you what you have to think, what you have to do, you're just like, no, I don't like that idea. I don't like the idea of somebody else having authority over my life. Or even if you've been a Christian for a very long time, maybe there are just certain areas, certain things, when Jesus is maybe challenging you on decisions you're making for your future, when you are thinking about your relationships, when you're thinking about your money, you just refuse to let Jesus have his authority. But Christ's resurrection shows that he has the authority. And who are we to say no to the one who can raise who was raised from the dead? His resurrection shows us that it's foolish to resist him. His resurrection shows us also that we can have hope and comfort in him, because all of God's plans always end in glory. And the resurrection also shows us that we can trust Jesus even with our lives. So don't hold on to those keys, but let Jesus have the authority over us. Thirdly and finally, I want us just to think also about the disciples in this story. They hadn't been following Jesus that long. This is quite earlier on in his ministry. And so they're still trying to figure out, who is this man? Who is this Jesus? And at the time of this event, they didn't really get it. They probably left that day being kind of confused, like, what was going on? What did he do all that for? Why did he say these things? Didn't really seem to make any sense. But then later, after the resurrection, when they started replaying it in their heads, then it made sense. And that's quite often the way in life. There are times when we're like, I have no idea what God is doing. I have no idea why this has happened. But it's only much later do we look back on it and then realize that there was a plan and a purpose in it. But after his death, they realized that he'd been talking about his body. But I think they realized a few more things as well. I think they also realized that when Jesus talked about, made this connection between his body and his temple, he was making a much greater statement about who he was. See, because the temple never was the place God intended it to be. It never was this pure and perfect place of uncorrupted worship. And so Jesus came not necessarily to reform the temple, but actually to replace it. That Christ, through his words and through his actions, is showing that actually he is now the temple of God. And we see this theme coming up a few times in John. So in the prologue, it talks about God making his dwelling among us. That actually, literally, that God templed among his people. In the few verses just before this, when Jesus is turning water into wine, it's a symbol that with the coming of Jesus comes something new and better. Later on, with the woman at the well, he will tell her that a time is coming when people will no longer worship in buildings, but they will worship in spirit and in truth. And then John in Revelation 21 has this great vision of the new heavens and the new earth, and he says that he doesn't see a temple because God and its Lamb are its temple. Jesus is heaven on earth. He is the meeting place between God and man. He is God's special. special dwelling place. So now if we want to worship or to pray, we go to Jesus. If we want to make a sacrifice or an offering, or we want to find forgiveness, we go to Jesus. If we want to experience God's special presence, or we want to witness his glory, we go to Jesus. Jesus is the true temple of God. He is the purity of God. The temple of the physical building of the temple was never that pure place. But Christ is the only one who is purity, who is right in God's sight, which qualifies him to be the only one that can come in and purify us, because he is the true temple. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled all this. And in verse 22, it says that they then believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. That when they combined the events that Jesus did, when they looked at the Old Testament with the light of the resurrection, it caused them to believe in Jesus. They believed that he was passionate about purity. They believed that he has all the authority. And they believed that Jesus is at the very center of everything. And my prayer for all of us this morning is that we believe those things too. But maybe we need to ask, are there pigeons that we've brought into our lives, things that we need to get rid of? Are there keys maybe that we're holding on to that we need to give to Jesus? Or is our worship or our lives focused on anything else but of Jesus Christ?